Good afternoon. I'm David Chappell. Welcome to this session on operational data services on Azure. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to walk through the basic technologies, the technology basics of the major operational data services on Azure, and I'll talk about the comparison among them as we go. Then at the end, I'm going to summarize the key factors that seem to drive the choice for most people I talk with, okay? So we'll spend a bunch of time looking at what they're like, and then we'll end with a look at a more direct comparison of factors that might drive you to choose one or another of these options. To do that, though, let's start by thinking about data today and the way we use data today. I would argue that data is as critical as it ever was. The folks who pay us care the most about data. When I talk to CIOs or IT leaders about cloud platforms, they will often express their concerns about their data being on cloud platforms, but almost no one ever worries about their code on cloud platforms. Data is really important. In fact, you might remember, or you might know, that our field for a long, long time was actually called data processing. And in some ways, I kind of miss that term, because it helped us really get a clear handle on what was most important about what we do. The data is really critical, certainly as much as it ever was. Data is not just more critical, it's also much more plentiful. There's so much of it. We can afford to store so much because disk is so cheap, and we have new sources of data that produce lots and lots and lots of stuff for us to store. And finally, responding to all of this, we've seen a rise in new data technologies. You know, for such a long time, decades, data was kind of boring, right? I mean, there was SQL, and then there was SQL. And then you might, instead of that, use SQL. And that was pretty much the data story for decades, decades and decades. And so that's changed. Now we see a huge increase in NoSQL, parallel analytics like Hadoop, and support for streaming data, lots of exciting stuff happening in this space. Unsurprisingly, you got to think about this data in some coherent way. There's got to be some way to break this into categories. And here is a categorization that I find most useful. Is this the only one possible? I don't think so, but it's the one I find most useful. I'm going to group data by how we use it. And I'm going to group data into three big buckets. The first big bucket is operational data. This is data that you actually use in applications to maintain current state. It's read-write. You read it. You modify it. And examples are things like, well, shopping carts, CRM info, e-commerce info. Applications use operational data to do what they do. It's the heart of data. For a long time, this is all there was. And this, of course, is our focus this afternoon. I'll talk about Azure services that address this. What I won't talk about is Azure services that address analytical data, second category. This is, I would argue, fundamentally different than operational data. I mean, for one thing, it's read-only. It's historical data used for analysis. So it tends to get much bigger than operational data because we store it over historical time, not just a snapshot in time. And it's used for things like data warehousing or machine learning, analytical data. And the third category that I think is useful here is this notion of streaming data. It's data that if you don't process it really quickly, often in milliseconds, it loses a big share of its value. You've got to process this stuff right now to be valuable, real-time data processing. And the canonical scenario here has become IoT. Internet of Things scenarios are sometimes viewed in this light. For a while, there was a push toward this notion of complex event processing, CEP, and Microsoft gave us a technology for that, but it wasn't terribly successful. It never became a real mainstream thing. And now streaming is mostly about IoT. So I'm going to talk about the leftmost of these, operational data, and specifically about the solutions on Azure for operational data. So Let's look at all of the Azure stuff here, data services. I will divide these into the three categories of subscribe, and then in rows into relational and non-relational services, because that distinction is still important, even though there's now a lot more than conventional relational. So for operational, relational on Azure, the story is SQL Database. It was called SQL Azure for many years. It's called SQL Database today. In the non-relational world, commonly called the NoSQL world, there's a bunch of choices. There's DocumentDB, there's tables, there's HBase. For analytical data, I'm sorry, before I do that, one more thing. HBase is actually part of this larger offering on Azure called HD Insight. As we'll see, HD Insight has technologies that span all these categories, and that's because HD Insight is in fact an implementation on Azure of the Hadoop technologies. And the Hadoop technology family has stuff across all three of those categories. HBase is the analytical piece, and there's more. So for relational analytical on Azure, there's SQL Data Warehouse, designed to do table-based, relational-based data warehousing. There's also a bunch of non-relational things. There's Data Lake Analytics, Data Lake Store, there's Machine Learning, there's Data Factory, and in the HD Insight, the Hadoop bucket, there's support for Hadoop, Hive, and Spark, other things in the Hadoop family that are for analytics. And finally, over on the streaming side, there's Stream Analytics, which I've categorized here as relational, because when you use this, what you do is create a SQL query that effectively is a standing query processing streams of data that come in. It's interesting. So it uses SQL, which is why I lumped it in the relational bucket. In the non-relational bucket, there's IoT Hub, there's Event Hubs, and then as part of HD Insight, there's support for both Storm and Spark streaming. So Azure has a lot of stuff for processing data. And more things show up regularly. In this session, in our remaining half an hour or whatever we have, we're going to look at just this, the operational, relational, and non-relational technologies on Azure. Okay? I don't know about you, but I never like looking at small things unless I know what the big thing is they're part of, which is why I spent this time doing this bigger thing that it's part of. So bear with me here. Okay. Let's start with SQL Database. You probably know this technology, but bear with me because I'm going to use this as an example for what comes next. So more than introducing SQL here, I want to introduce the example I want to use. So SQL Database is a relational service, of course. It has tables like relations everywhere. In those tables, you have columns with names and types. Here, for example, the illustration I want to use is this. Suppose we're building on Azure some kind of service that keeps track of users. Maybe it's a game, maybe it's something else. It keeps track of users and what they're doing. So here, the columns include the username, the country they're from, their age, when they last used the service. And in relational databases, there's a unique key in each row. Here, I've given them an ID. Great. There's also rows of data with the key value and other things, and applications issue SQL queries and get back relations, tables, rows and columns. Wonderful. We all know this. It is really hard to overstate the degree to which SQL has been a stable and dominant technology. My first book came out in 1989. It was an intro to SQL. It was one of the first broad SQL books out there. As of last year, last time I checked, that book in a second edition, which was about 5% different than the first one, almost the exact same book, was still on the syllabus at MIT for a course. That's how stable SQL has been. It's incredibly consistent. And it's not going away. I know people who are hardcore NoSQL fans who think that the rise of NoSQL means the demise, the death of SQL. I got to tell you, I think this is just nuts. I'm not a zealot. My goal here is not to convince you why you should never use relational, always use NoSQL. Heck no. My goal to try to give you the pros and cons of each and help make good choices, because that's the right solution. And I should tell you, my default position here is, if you can use a familiar, well-understood relational database like SQL database for your problem, you should. If it solves your problem, use this, because it's well-known, it's straightforward, it's well-supported, it's simple, it's powerful, great. But there are situations where you can't, and we'll come back to that in just a minute. Before we do, some technology basics here. The terminology you often hear is sharding. People sometimes say partitioning. Sharding is a more common term. And the idea is this. I might have a database, and I might have data in that database about people in this case. Here's the issue. What happens when I have lots and lots and lots of data in that database? Well, the answer is I buy a bigger machine, right? I scale up with a bigger machine. The challenge, of course, is that beyond a certain point, I just can't scale up anymore. I can't buy a big enough machine. So beyond a certain point, I must be able to scale out by buying more machines, not a bigger and bigger machine. To do that with a database, I must divide the database across different machines. I must shard it. So here, for example, I've chosen to shard my example database based on the first name of the person whose data is stored there. Simple little example. In real life, you might choose to shard based on some identifier that's embedded in the data that can be used to effectively group data across systems. But sharding is really important. Sharding is how we get massive scale, typically. But like almost everything in software, in computer science, there are trade-offs. Sharding gives me scale, but it takes away atomic transactions. If I want to do an atomic transaction across two or more shards, typically I can't. In these databases, we'll talk about it. Not always, you'll see. But in the main, you're going to see they just don't support atomic transactions across shards. You can. Two-phase commit will do it, but it's slow. It's just slow, and it can be problematic. So sharding for scale is a cool thing, but you lose stuff, like typically atomic transactions. Interestingly, SQL Database now actually has in preview these elastic database tools that will do sharding in a relational system. They will even do atomic transactions across multiple shards. They've built into SQL Database the functionality that on Windows is in Distributed Transaction Coordinator, DTC. So you can do two-phase commit across shards. So it's interesting, because there are cases when it's useful. Throughout this talk, however, when I say SQL Database, I don't mean SQL Database with sharding. I mean SQL Database without this in preview elastic database capability. Okay? So why wouldn't I always use SQL Database? When you look at its functionality, it's relational, it's familiar. Well, that's a cool thing. The abstractions it uses for storage are simple, familiar, tables, rows, columns. Ah, the max database size. Without the sharding option, in SQL Database, a single database can't exceed a terabyte of data. And that's the high end. It's reasonably expensive to get up there. The query language is SQL, which we all know. It has great transaction support. Again, if I don't shard, covers the entire database, rows and tables. It has secondary indexes. Quick review here. In relational systems, you always index in the primary key to find things. But you can also, if you choose to, create indexes on other columns in the table, making it fast and easy to search on that column of data as well. Secondary indexes. Useful. It's a nice thing for data that will be accessed not just by its key. You can write stored procedures in T-SQL, and the pricing model here is interesting. The pricing model is based on throughput. It's not really based on how big your database is. Now, that turns out to be part of it. But you can have a small database that you're paying a lot for because you're paying for very high throughput. So the pricing you get here is really about throughput, performance, more than it is about the size of the data you're storing. It's related. That's a function as well. But the cost is mostly throughput. All right, so SQL database has a lot going for it. Familiar, powerful, but there are scenarios where no SQL operational data is really attractive. I would suggest that there are three big scenarios where people tend to go toward NoSQL. Three big reasons why they use NoSQL for operational data. One of them is scale. To scale for large numbers of users and large amounts of data. And that tends to mean terabytes, petabytes, large amounts of data. Because NoSQL technologies commonly offer more scalability than relational databases. However, pros and cons, they do this by sharding, which means you lose things such as database-wide atomic transactions. Is it worth it? Depends on your application, on your scenario. Another reason that people use NoSQL technologies is this. It lets them work more effectively with other data formats, especially with JSON. People more and more want to use JSON data. And so if I have a database that lets me store directly as JSON, that means I can avoid the pain of object relational mapping. If I'm writing in JavaScript, for example, and I can store JSON data, well, that's a beautiful thing. Life is simple and good. What's bad about that? Well, a JavaScript application storing JSON data is like an object application storing object data. And you might remember, some of you, the fate of object databases. Somewhat 15, 20 years ago, they crashed and burned to a great degree. Largely because object databases are really great for storing data used by a single application, but they're really hard to share. It's hard to share that data in the database when it's designed for just one app to use. Now, you might argue, you might say, well, wait, but sharing data in a database at that level is bad anyway. You shouldn't do that. You'd share data through APIs. Okay, fine, legitimate. But there are trade-offs here. The third big reason that I see people choose NoSQL is for flexibility. Flexibility in how they work with their data. Because NoSQL databases almost always have no schema, no required schema. So you've got this great flexibility. Super. However, schema is your friend in so many cases, is it not? Schema is what lets you know if you write a character value into an integer field. It stops you. Schema is your friend. So getting rid of schema gives you flexibility, but there's cost there as well. It's like so many things, right? Nothing is free. So, pros and cons in general of NoSQL. Let's talk about the three big NoSQL operational data services on Azure. First, DocumentDB, commonly called just DocDB. It's a document store. If anybody is familiar with MongoDB, DocDB is like MongoDB in a bunch of ways. Not exactly the same, but it's like Mongo in a bunch of ways, except it's a service. It's not a database server sitting up there. It's a database service, a managed service, where you create databases and use them and pay per use. You're not getting a running database instance in the sense of a DBMS server. Okay? Matter of fact, MongoDB is so popular that DocDB, not too long ago, added support for the MongoDB APIs. So you can now access DocDB as if it were MongoDB. It's interesting. So here's the model. A DocDB collection contains some number of documents. Each document contains data as JSON. Now, as you probably know, JSON is a text format. So here's an example. Document 1 says that there's a user here whose name is John. His country is Canada. He's 43 years old. The last use was March 4th. Now, if you recall my SQL example, those were the columns in the table after the unique ID. DocDB maintains unique ID for documents as well. I don't show it here, but it's there. So in DocDB, I can store as JSON data in a document the same kinds of stuff. But because there's no schema, I could have another document that describes Ava, you would say, in Holland, who's 25. I don't know her last use. Well, that's okay, just leave it out. There's no schema. DocDB won't care. I could even do this. I could have a third document that's about Lou in Australia. He's 51, and I don't know Lou's last use. But I know Lou's first use. I'll put that in instead. That's okay. It's a document. I could even do this. My fourth document might be a document that maintains a count of how many other documents there are in this collection, along with the date the last one was added. There's no schema. So I can just drop whatever I want into these JSON documents. Okay, a document database. Applications can send in requests. What they get back is, no surprise, JSON. They get back JSON. And those requests can be standard REST requests, gets and puts, or there's a query language that's based on, derived from SQL. It's not SQL, but it's what they call an extended subset of SQL. So it's SQL-esque. Great. Why do folks use this? I mentioned earlier that people choose these things sometimes for the data model. So suppose I'm building an app on AppService, one of Azure's PaaS technologies, and I'm using the Node.js option to build server-side code in JavaScript. Suppose my clients, browser, mobile clients, are in JavaScript or at least send JSON back and forth. Well, if I'm doing with JSON and JavaScript, using DocDB, which stores data in JSON, is a beautiful fit. It's just a beautiful fit. I've got the same language everywhere. I've got the same data format everywhere. I didn't say this, but DocDB also supports stored procedures. And to write stored procedures in DocDB, I have to use JavaScript. So if I'm a big fan of JavaScript, and I'm using JSON throughout, I've got this very clean environment. I've got the same data formats, the same languages everywhere. It's attractive. I've talked to lots of developers who have chosen to use either this or MongoDB for the data format, for this reason, not for scale, because of this commonality, this relative simplicity across the whole environment. Okay, I've talked to developers who've chosen to use this because it was new and cool. This is a really bad reason to use something, I would suggest. I mean, if it's for a fun project, yes. If it's for real life, not a good motivation, in my opinion. How about sharding and transactions? Well, DocDB shards. It spreads data across machines. Originally, until quite recently, unit of sharding was a collection. And still, the default unit of sharding is a collection. So by default, it will not break collections across machines. So a collection and the shard are the same thing by default. The problem with that is that it means that collections cannot get beyond a certain size. And so just this year, they're adding the ability to partition collections. So they're separating the notion of collections and shard, which was not true previously. MongoDB's always done this, so it's like Mongo now, where you separate those two. So you can actually now break collections across machines if you choose to. But of course, as I mentioned earlier, when you shard, when you partition, you lose, typically, atomic transactions. So that's true here as well. Atomic transactions can only happen across a single collection, or if you partition your collection, across a partition in that collection. So you cannot do, in DocDB, atomic transactions that span machine boundaries, thus the shard boundaries. So think about that. What that means is that if you want to use transactions, you're probably going to need to organize your data in such a way that you won't need transactions that go beyond a given collection or collection partition if you've done that. So that means that your app has to have a good sense of how it's going to use the data before you just run the data, organize the data inside your database. This is really typical of NoSQL. It's a situation where your app typically will know about data access patterns when you create the database. It's typical of NoSQL. It's antithetical to relational. In the relational model, you try so hard to design your tables and so on to be accessed in all sorts of ways. But in the NoSQL world, you often don't. You commonly have some knowledge about how data will be accessed, because if you don't, you wind up having a very tough time getting scale and other things you want. Some more technology basics here. NoSQL databases commonly replicate data, and they commonly do it at the level of a shard. So you might have a shard, let's call it shard A, on some machine in this NoSQL system. And you might then also have, let's say, two other copies of that same shard on other machines. And it's common, although not universal, to have one of those shards be primary, which means it's read-write, and the others be secondary, they're read-only. DocDB works that way, for example. So, why is that good? Sharding is good because it improves both performance and availability. It improves performance, replication is good because it improves both performance and availability. It improves performance because I can now spread my reads, at least, across different systems rather than all go to the same machine. That's good. It improves availability because if a machine goes down, I still have access to the data. If the primary goes down, I can only read, but I can still get at the data. So replication makes good sense. However, nothing is free. Nothing is ever free. So replication brings with it some challenges. The big one is this. If I write to, let's say, the primary replica here, when I write to that guy, that change, that modification, will eventually get propagated to the secondaries. It's got to, right? It's going to take a little while. I mean, it might take a few hundred milliseconds, not a long time, but it's going to take a little while to get there. What happens if the scenario works out like this? I do a write to the primary. It's in the process of replicating to the secondaries, and you do a read at this exact second, millisecond, you do a read to one of those secondary replicas, and the write hasn't gotten there yet. What happens? Well, there are various options. Right. Option number one is you get the wrong data. Right. You get old data and it's just wrong. Tough. Option number two is you don't get to read. You get blocked until the write replicates and is done, and then you get to read. That's a little bit slower. You've got to wait a little bit, a little slower. But the other option, you get data right away, but it might be wrong. Which do you prefer? Well, the answer, commonly, depends on your app. There are apps where getting the right data all the time is priority one in every scenario. And so you want what's called strong consistency, where you never see old data. You'll be blocked while that propagation's occurring. Once it's done, you can read. Super. Strong concurrency. Or you might prefer an app where you want immediate response right now. If the data's a little bit old, you don't care. That's called eventual consistency. Well, turns out, those are two big options, but there are others as well. There are things in between. In general, NoSQL databases must deal with this problem. In DocDB, you have options. It supports strong, it supports eventual, and it supports a couple of intermediate options as well, which you can set as a developer in the database or on a per-request basis. So, interesting problem, one that tends to afflict all these systems because they all replicate data, and one that DocDB solves by giving you control with a bunch of options, four of them, on how this works. So in my table here, DocDB is a document store. As we saw, the abstractions are collections and documents. The max database size is really big, hundreds of terabytes. It'll just expand. Collections across machines can get very large. The query language, mentioned earlier, is this variant of SQL. Transaction support, limited to a collection or a partition of a collection, if you have partitioned your collection. Secondary indexes, yes. Matter of fact, DocDB indexes everything you give it. Every single thing you put in is made part of an index. Search for anything rapidly. That's interesting. Store procedures, yes. They're in JavaScript, as I mentioned earlier. And pricing is like SQL DB. It's in throughput. In fact, if you notice here, DocDB is similar in many ways to SQL DB, except DocDB uses JSON documents, not relational tables. So it's similar in many ways. Also similar, at least in some ways, is the third choice, tables. Sometimes called table storage. I'm going to say tables. Tables are really old. Tables were in the original Azure release back in 2009, the preview release, long ago, right? They've been here a long time, long time. They've not changed much in all that time. Tables are a key value store. And what that means is really simple. It means you give it a key, it returns values. It's kind of like a fancy hash table. Give it a key, get back data associated with that key. And it looks like this. With tables, you define partitions. Here I show A and B. What's a partition? It's a shard. You define shards in a given table. Then, in each partition, you have some number of entities, which they also call rows in some situations, but same thing. Don't be confused. The terminology is like a relational system, but it's not. They're not tables. They're not rows in the sense of relational tables and rows. Then, entities contain properties. Each entity always has a property that acts as the partition key. It contains an indication of what partition this guy's in. So there, the top two are in A, bottom two are in B. There's then this thing called the row key, which I so wish was called the entity key, because that's what it is. It's a unique value for this entity within that partition. You can see here A1, A2, B1, B2. We're defining unique names for those entities. We're also telling it how to find them, partition A, partition B. Then the rest of the entity contains data. So for example, to keep with my same illustration of the data we're storing, you might have name, which is a string, the country of the user, their age, their last use. This is the same as the example I showed you in the DocDB scenario. The next one might be name, country, only age. There's no schema, once again. Put whatever you want in there. There's no schema. Next, name, country, age, first use. And as you might recall, the fourth document was very different. It had the count and the last creation. I can express all those same things in these entities with the types defined by Azure tables. You know, my diagrams don't really make this super clear, but I mentioned earlier that in DocDB, each document has a unique identifier. So in DocDB, I can do queries in the data and search through indexes, all this cool stuff, but I can also say, DocDB, here is my identifier, give me back the document. Here I say, here is the partition and entity I want, give me back the data. So here I've asked for B2, so I'm going to get back these last two things in B2. Do you see how DocDB is in some ways also a key value store, except the values are JSON documents? In DocDB, I can give an identifier, unique identifier, get back the document. Here, I give the identifier, like B2, and get back the entity. So in some sense, document databases are also key value stores, but the value is a JSON document. There is overlap here. Tables. They do sharding. As I mentioned earlier, unit of sharding is a partition. All right, great. Unsurprisingly, transaction support is limited to a single partition because that's the sharding unit. You can't span machines with transactions, atomic transactions. And although I don't always show it here, partitions are always, they can be in the same machine, but they can be different machines as well. So you can't span transactions with those guys. And it replicates partitions, and it always does strong consistency. The thing about tables is that tables as a key value store is really simple. The abstractions seem kind of messy sometimes, but the scale is terrific. The queries are really simple. Mostly you say, here's the entity I want, give me back the data. You can do a bit more, but not too much. Transaction support is somewhat limited. There are no secondary indexes. If you want to search for data, not the key, but data, you got to search. Just go through the whole thing. It's a big pain. Not designed for that. There are no secondary indexes. There are no stored procedures. They're simple. But the trade-off here is that for that simplicity, you pay very little. All you pay for is gigabytes of storage. That's it. And you're paying at the same price as Azure Blobs, which is incredibly cheap. Tables are really cheap. They are really cheap. So if what you have is relatively simple data access requirements, tables can be a great choice because they're so darn cheap. You know, tables are not the only key value store technology in Azure. A quick digression here. Suppose I've got an app being accessed by some user. The app accesses data from the user or stored in some persistent service, whether it's SQL database, DocDB tables, whatever. Okay. If that data will be accessed frequently, it can make sense to cache it, to store it in something closer to the app than those data services. That's the role of Azure Redis Cache. Redis, as you might know, is an open source database technology, NoSQL database technology, that works as a database or as a cache. In Azure, it's provided as a caching service that stores data in memory close to the application and then can be retrieved again. The idea is to let this data be accessed more quickly, it's going to be used a lot, than having to go back to the data service like SQL database all the time. Turns out that Redis is a key value store because key value stores are great for caches. What does a cache do? A cache takes the identifier and returns back the data. You don't search a cache on the values in the cache. You search it just on this identifier. So caches are a really good fit for key value stores. So Redis is not meant as a persistent database in the Azure implementation, but it's a key value store nonetheless. One more example here, HD Insight HBase. HBase, which is derived from Bigtable, a Google technology, part of the Hadoop distribution, and thus is an HD Insight. HBase is a little interesting. Its data model is non-obvious. You got tables, and they have rows and columns, like tables you're used to. But they're just not what you expect. There's always a row key, unique identifier. The columns here, as in my earlier examples, name, country, age, last use. I've added first use here as well. But you can add new columns on the fly. You can add new columns whenever you like to HBase on the fly. No schema, again. Columns, however, have to be grouped into column families. And you cannot add new column families on the fly, just new columns. So here I've defined two column families, user and usage. You then have the actual rows of data with a unique row key, and you have data in at least some of these cells. Not all. HBase is perfectly happy to have extremely sparse data. And notice something else. If you look here, you can see that in some of those cells, I have multiple instances of data because HBase will store versions of data for you. First version, you can write the next one and save the old one. Write the next one, save the old one. It will store versions for you. It's interesting. So when you go to query HBase, you can do this. You can say, HBase, I want in the column family usage, the column last use, row 2, version 2, and get that middle square rectangle right up there. You'll get back the thing you asked for. People call these column family stores. That's the name you hear most often. Cassandra is also similar to this. Once again, sharding in transactions, does it shard? Sure it does. It has to get massive scale. But this is also really interesting. The unit of sharding is called a region. And you're thinking, but David, you never mentioned regions earlier. And you're right. Unlike DocDB, unlike tables, the unit of sharding is not visible to the application. As an app developer, you don't see shards, because HBase shards for you silently under the covers. In fact, HBase can even move rows from shard to shard over time if it needs to balance. It shards for you, which is really cool. Except, like everything, it has trade-offs. The trade-off here is the following. The trade-off is, if I, as an app developer, can't see the shard boundaries, what about transactions? As I've said over and over, in these systems, transaction boundaries match shard boundaries. If I can't see the shard boundaries, then how can I, as a developer, know what I can have in a transaction? Which records? Well, the answer is, I can't. And so, you know what HBase does? HBase says you can have transactions, no problem, on a single row, on just one row. Because beyond that, you can't know what rows will be in the same shard. You can't see that as a developer. I love this. I don't mean I love this solution. It's got pros and cons. I mean, I love the fact that these different technologies address very similar problems in these different ways. It's really interesting to compare them, isn't it? I think it is. All right, we're almost done here. So HBase fits in my column, my table like this. It's a column family store. I mentioned it earlier. It's got these various storage abstractions, massive scale, hundreds of terabytes. You can query this guy with a SQL subset in an open source project called Phoenix, which is supported in HD Insight. You can do that. Transactions are very constrained. There are no secondary indexes. You can do stored procedures in Java. And the pricing is interesting. This is part of HBase. I'm sorry, part of HD Insight. And HD Insight on Azure requires you to create a cluster of VMs. And you pay for that cluster. And it's used for all of your Hadoop stuff, whether you're running Hive queries or Spark stuff or HBase. And so you're paying for that VM cluster as it's running, plus you're paying for your storage, gigabytes of data, in blobs, say, or Azure Data Lake. So the pricing here is a little bit complicated. All right, let's finish. How do you choose a technology? Well, you decide what you care about. For each one of these, there is what I'm going to call a unique benefit. This special thing about it that might make you choose it for that reason alone. SQL database, for example, the unique benefit is it's familiar. We'll get there in a minute. You might also want flexible schemas. You might want a database bigger than a terabyte. You might want transaction support at varying levels, secondary indexes, stored procedures and triggers, and you might want to use relational analysis tools. So with SQL database, the unique benefit I just said is familiarity. Your people already know it. You already know it. You can start using it right away rather than learning, say, DocDB or tables or HBase, something different. Flexible schema? No. Data is bigger than 1 terabyte? No, unless you do the Elastic Database, the sharding option, which is in preview right now. But transactions, terrific support. Really good transaction support. Secondary indexes, great. Stored procedures, yes. And you can use the plethora of available relational analysis tools. You can use all sorts, decades worth, of relational analysis tools on relational data. That can be a big plus in some cases. But maybe those things aren't crucial to you. Maybe you are a hardcore JSON person. That's a unique benefit of DocDB, that it lets you deal with data as JSON. doing JavaScript might be a very appealing thing. Don't be confused. I can certainly use DocDB from C#, other languages. It's not just for JavaScript. My point only is it's an especially nice fit for JavaScript. Flexible schemas, yes. Very big databases, yes. Transactional support, pretty good. Not at the level of SQL database, but secondary indexes, yes. Stored procedures, yes. Relational analysis, no. If I choose a NoSQL database, I'm also implicitly choosing to do data analysis later on with some non-relational tool like Hadoop or Spark. Probably. I shouldn't say Hadoop. It's a technology family. I mean Hive, typically. Hive, Spark, something like that. Okay? So that's an important choice as well. You're not choosing just operational data. You're implicitly also choosing an analytical choice, analytical technology. For tables, the unique benefit is they're so darn cheap. If all you care about is money, choose tables. And you also get flexible schema, big databases, moderate transaction support, but no secondary indexes, no stored procedures, no relational analysis tools. For HBase, the big win, the unique thing, is it's part of HD Insight. If you're doing other HD Insight things, like Spark, you're then already paying for and running that VM cluster. HBase can be almost free. Fits in really nicely in that case. If you're running other HD Insight technologies, HBase is an attractive choice in that case. It also gives you the usual NoSQL stuff, of flexible schemas, big databases. My remote just stopped working. Okay, big databases. Very limited transactions and pretty much nothing else, right? No secondary indexes, stored procedures, relational analysis tools. So I've tried in the columns here to indicate the things that so often drive choices, to give you perhaps a useful summary to think about what you might choose. So I'm out of time. I hope this is useful. If nothing else, I hope it's interesting, because it's really fun to see how these different technologies address the same set of problems in such different ways. Thank you very much.